Does the gospel free you to do what you want? I've written an article in the latest issues, etc. journal titled Better Than Good, Failed Attempts to Improve on the Gospel. You can read it by subscribing to the online Issues, etc. journal. Just click the red subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. You can also read Pastor Brian Ketchelmeyer's spiritual journey from Roman Catholicism and American Evangelicalism to Confessional Lutheranism. The free online Issues, Etc. journal.
You can put half of Trump's supporters into what I call the basket of deplorables. Right? The racist, sexist, homophobic, xenophobic, Islamophobic, you name it.
It was perhaps the most explicit attack on the American voter ever spoken by a major party presidential nominee.
That's Hillary Clinton speaking in September at an LGBT fundraiser in New York in a response, brief as it was, from Donald Trump. Basket of deplorables. Now, she was talking about Trump supporters, and after this election, it seems as though they're talking about everyone who voted for Donald Trump or who didn't vote for Donald Trump. Social conservatism seems to be painted often in that kind of dark color. We're going to be talking about social conservatism and the election results. Aaron Wolf is a regular guest. He's managing editor of Chronicles, a magazine of American culture, and he's author of a recent column titled Roll Up Your Sleeves, Deplorables. Aaron, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you. It is good to be back.
You recently wrote this. Conservatives might want to start thinking right now about what they will demand of their elected Republican government, seeing those Republicans may not have any excuses left. We must be ready to hold their feet to the fire because the media will assault them with charges of racism and sexism, et cetera, immediately. And they will in turn begin to think about re-election. That goes for the president and the Congress. What did you mean by that?
Yes, and I even had qualified that when I posted that because all the election results were not in yet. And then once they did come in, I expanded on that a little bit in an article that indeed we must do this. We must start to think not just philosophically, but strategically about where we are. That is, social conservatives, Christian conservatives, who, whatever our opinion of the personal character of Donald Trump, now in fact have a President Donald Trump and essentially a bulletproof Congress. So where does that leave us? And when I mentioned that the liberal media will begin to attack immediately, I mean, since I wrote those words, it's already started. They don't sleep. They have a 24-hour news cycle. They have an entertainment industry. And they did not all shrivel up and die at the stroke of midnight on election night. And so what I've seen as the tactic that they've used, and heaven help us, Donald Trump gave them plenty of ammunition, but it is to take the policies that he proposed, many of which I think were at the core conservative, and in fact some of which were deeply conservative, and yet kind of went against the grain of the standard Republican platform, standard Republican way of talking about things like, particularly like immigration. But what the media did immediately with him was to begin to use the things in his personal character that are obviously immoral, the things that make people uncomfortable, and tie those things to the policy proposals that he was making, so that if you say this, then that means you are that. If you say that you want to deport illegal immigrants, for example. That makes you a racist. And how do we know that Donald Trump's a racist? Well, because some racists like him. And that kind of ideological framework is still fully in place in the liberal media. And those are the paradigms in which he will be evaluated before he even takes office. And so even as the returns were coming in, and I was thinking, because honestly, I did not think that he would, ahead of time, that he would win that election. I thought it would be close. I really was surprised, along with everyone else. But even as those returns started to show that he was winning Florida, winning Ohio, I started thinking, well, if this happens, what's next? And what is most likely to happen given the current state of political discourse and rhetoric?
Okay, so you're doing far more than simply saying, conservatives, social conservatives, we have an opportunity, an unprecedented opportunity in terms of control of the levers of power in government. Let's make it count. You are saying there's a counter force here that is going to very quickly and probably successfully rob us of that opportunity as soon as it can.
They will try, and I have hope. I don't ever want to put my ultimate hope in politics. I think that itself is deeply unconservative, and not to mention goes against the psalmist who says, "Put not your trust in princes." And I think it applies here. But I do have hope that we, because we have an opportunity, but. You're absolutely right. I think that the forces that would work against that are already at work and already looking for the best ways to shave off these issues one by one, to frame them. And the advantage there really does go to the liberal media, because we're all kind of addicted to it. I mean, we watch television, we watch movies, we listen to pop music, we consume politics as entertainment, really, whatever our bent is as a people. So then with social media, we just can't seem to stop sharing and liking and disliking now all sorts of political memes. And I even did a thought experiment at home. We were talking about this, and said, "What? How would this election have gone if it were like the days when people had to just read a newspaper, and rural people maybe did that when they went into town? You know, the way that issues are characterized and the sort of binary nature of either you believe X, Y, and Z, and that makes you a Nazi, or the other side's way of looking at that. Those things just draw fuel and are fired by our constant interaction with media. And so, on one level, you have to say, well, conservatives are at a disadvantage there because the liberals control the media. That's just a fact. And then the other, I guess, deeper question there is, how does the medium itself, whether it's social media or television news, how does that shape political thought? How does that draw out the kind of sort of binary like or dislike response that it has become just instinctive for us now, so that there are those who are tempted, and I've already talked to a lot of these people, who are tempted to say, well, Trump is our guy now, and therefore, you know, we're not going to criticize him publicly because he's our guy. And the same goes for the other side. There were a few rare moments of honesty about Hillary Clinton as candidate I heard on NPR in the wake of the Trump-pocalypse, where they were talking about what an awful candidate she was, just in terms of her presentation and her appeal, et cetera. But that was over very quickly. I mean, they were still in shock, so I guess we'll give them a pass on that. But they've already gone back to framing questions of immigration, of marriage, and any kind of minority issue, transgender issues, issues of homosexuality, all of that in terms of stark fear. And they have that kind of pulpit from which to preach, and Americans just can't seem to turn it off. So that's the reason why I call for a kind of crystallization of thought, that conservatives need to start thinking about how to respond, how to frame these issues in a tough and courageous and winsome way, so that when these conversations happen, and they are going to happen immediately, that we don't think of these issues in terms of the paradigms that the media presents to us constantly and which we constantly consume.
On the other side of the break, we'll get a little more specific. He mentioned their charges of racism and sexism. We'll start with racism. Aaron Wolf is our guest, managing editor of Chronicles, a magazine of American culture. We're talking about social conservatism and the election results.
Memoria Press invites all Issues Etc. listeners to explore our Simply Classical curriculum, a set of full-year academic curriculum packages for children with learning challenges. Our classical writing program and our Christian studies are now based on your favorite CPH Bible storybooks. To learn more, visit classicalspecialneeds.com and use promo code LPR to save on your initial purchase. That's classicalspecialneeds.com.
Christians, young and old, are increasingly pressured to change their beliefs. That's why St. Jude said we need to contend for the faith once for all delivered to the saints. At the San Antonio Worldview Conference, Confessional Lutherans Jonathan Fisk, Jay Weber, Ryan McPherson, and Craig Parton will unmask the false, direct us to Christ and His Word, and defend the faith. The San Antonio Worldview Conference, Saturday, February the 11th, San Antonio, Texas. Visit worldviewsa.org. worldusa.org.
Where Christianity meets culture, you're listening to Issues Etc.
At Risen Christ Lutheran Church in Arvada, Colorado, we have simply become captivated by the hilarious notion that God has sent His Son, Jesus Christ, into the world to save the losers of this world, losers just like us. We proclaim the biblical notion that God saves sinners. Embracing the historic liturgy of the church, we confess that we are just that, sinners. Visit us online at risenchristlutheran.org.
Issues Etc. is listener-supported. We rely on you for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Now, if you appreciate Issues Etc., please consider making a tax-deductible gift today. You can make a secure online contribution at issuesetc.org. You can also donate by check. Make your check payable to Issues Etc. and send it to Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Thanks for your support.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. on this Thursday afternoon, November the 10th. We're talking with Aaron Wolf of Chronicles Magazine about social conservatism and the election results. He's authored a recent column, Roll Up Your Sleeves, Deplorables. Before the break, you were talking about charges of racism and sexism that are inevitably going to fly here against the Republican Party, and I guess right now the party that controls White House and both branches of the legislature, and perhaps in the future the Supreme Court, at least in its ideology. What do you mean by charges of racism and sexism, starting with racism?
Sure. Well, again, the immigration issue. You know, this was something that over the summer, it dumbfounded me really to see the way the Republicans who were very nervous about Donald Trump, didn't take the opportunity to use the immigration plan that he put forth, which began with this sort of axiomatic statement, I think, that if you don't have borders, you don't have a country. And to talk about that, for conservatives, take the opportunity to expand on that, to say, why, yes, that is sort of definitionally true. And how did we wind up today with this kind of ideology of semi or porous borders, and how is it that we just blithely accept this kind of nation of immigrants ideology that we have, that there's no distinctions among peoples, that anyone from anywhere can just sort of check off a list of our values, whoever gets to define those, and there's no barrier at all between that person and be enjoying all the benefits of an American citizen. Instead, everyone seemed to be running scared of the charge of racism, and that was applied to the Hispanics who were here, whether they were illegal immigrants or legal immigrants, and which I think we saw even during the election that nearly 30% nationwide, if exit polls are correct, of Hispanics who voted did not buy that characterization. But the Republicans for 15 or 20 years have made this argument that this is an issue we just don't want to touch because we're open to this charge of racism from the left, and they will beat it to death in the media, and they did, and they have. And then the thing was sort of applied as well to questions of Islamic immigration. That was framed in two ways. One was in terms of religious freedom and the idea of a religious test, which, you know, is language that actually comes from somewhere, and it had to do with federal office holders and in our Constitution. Presumably, they would already be citizens, but instead, we just heard over and over again this phrase "religious test." It had this sort of scent of antiquity to it, and so it got to be applied however the left wanted to apply it. And I think that this kind of sort of fundamental conservative thinking that needs to happen right now, so we get our heads screwed on straight to reply to this stuff. It didn't happen during the campaign very much. And I will say that, again, Donald Trump, while he seemed to have some instinctive good policy proposals, that he just wasn't very good at articulating them in a way that would explain why they are conservative ideas. And so you know, when he says when you don't have borders, you don't have a country, and then Republicans who were terrified of him came back with, you know, that this is we don't want to exclude anyone, we have a big tent, and they're kind of sending vague signals from Paul Ryan and his office that we, you know, this is only Trump, we're not anti-immigrant, we want you in our party. The response from Trump would then be something like, I love Mexicans, or Mexicans are great people, and it really wasn't to dig into to the question.
And what do you mean when you talk about charges of sexism?
Well, the questions about his approach toward women in the past can be applied to any kind of conservative who advocates traditional roles in marriage, the traditional concept of marriage, even issues regarding federal enforcement of equal pay, even in the abstract, the fact that he opposed Hillary Clinton at all was framed in those terms, because this was the opportunity to break the glass ceiling. And so pictures abounded of, you know, I voted stickers on the grave of Susan B. Anthony and such, and the opportunity to make history which was then denied. And you know, the stories abounded of you know, women going to the polls purely for this purpose, to see this, to participate in history. And what that implies then is that if you are in favor of anything remotely connected to Trump's approach to the marriage question, I don't mean in his personal life, but in terms of law or in terms of policy proposals, in terms of equal pay, in terms of the role of women in the military, which he seems to be all over the map on that, that you can be charged with sexism sort of in the vaguest way. And if you deny it, if you say, well, no, this is nothing to do with some kind of, prejudice against women in the abstract, well, then they can turn around and bring up all of these instances from Trump's past.
What do you mean that when you say that the new GOP government, at least for the time of political memory, will have no excuses?
Yes. Well, okay, so this is something that takes us back to the George W. Bush administration and questions about what was accomplished then when for a time there were Republicans in the Congress and a Republican in the White House. So we have a lot of things that culture-shaping things have come out of the Obama administration, things he didn't even run on, like question of gay marriage, where he said very specifically, I'm not in favor of gay marriage, and he said that right to Ellen DeGeneres' face. But okay, so these things have happened over the last 8 years, and Republicans have had an excuse that, you know, there's no legislation we could pass that would get past the president's veto. And they don't have that excuse now. Now, immediately following that comes the excuse of all time, which is the Supreme Court. And so it is true that, you know, even if Trump appoints someone from his famous list, who is in some sense in the spirit of Antonin Scalia or Clarence Thomas, which, you know, our legal affairs editor at Chronicle, Stephen Presser, looked over his list and was very impressed with it, and I hope he sticks to that list in terms of the names on it and their rulings and questions of federalism, etc. But even if he gets the replacement for Scalia in, we still have Anthony Kennedy there, who will will blow like a reed shaken in the wind, and will tend to side with the left on the court in terms of many of these social issues. That is true, and we can say that, well, maybe Ruth Bader Ginsburg will retire eventually. I don't know. It doesn't matter, because there still will be no excuse because of the way that Congress can bulletproof legislation through what we call, sort of in shorthand, strippers. And by that we mean the stripping of jurisdiction. And this is something that we wrote about in Chronicles back in the 2000s under the Bush administration, George W. administration. Whenever questions of the Defense of Marriage Act would come up, Congress would typically throw up their hands and say, well, this is something that we just can't get through in such a way the Supreme Court will shoot it down, or it's just not politically expedient. Maybe Congress would pass or the House would pass a version of it, and then it would die. But there's a way to take legislation about marriage, about transgender issues in terms of imposing certain types of bathroom usage in public places, there, with really any issue, and make it bulletproof, and that, or rather, at least make it bulletproof on the federal level, and that is simply to append the language of whatever the legislation is with the statement that this is not subject to review by the federal courts. And so it's in essence strips jurisdiction from the federal courts. Article 3 of the Constitution gives the Congress that power, and I mean, when you think about it, it makes sense, because otherwise there would be, other than the controversial question of nullification, which our country decided a long time ago, there would be no check at all on the Supreme Court. They could just take whatever case they wanted and say that it fell within their jurisdiction and then make a ruling, and that's clearly oligarchical rule. The Congress knows they have this power, and they avoid talking about it. They've used it. Even during those Bush years, they attempted in the House to protect the American flag with stripper language in a particular bill that died in the House and never made it to the Senate. But this is something that they could do that would accomplish a great deal and would bypass the federal courts, whether it's the lower ones, which they actually have the power to create or destroy, or the Supreme Court, which of course is mandated by the Constitution. And then any of these questions, again, simple majority, signature by the president, then it goes to the state. So any kind of appeal, any kind of challenge would go to state courts, and there you have federalism. There you have differences among the states. And this is something they now have an opportunity to do. They can, if they're serious about curbing abortion, you know, this famous Fetal Pain Act that struggled so mightily with 11th hour drama year before, just comes up year after year. This is a way to address these things, and we need to hold their feet to the fire on this, because they now have a signature from the president that they should be able to get, and therefore they are without excuse when it comes to these things. That's one aspect of, that's one way, one big way that I think that they're without excuse, and there are others. Trump has plainly said that he wants to either abolish or at least gut the Department of Education. And for conservatives who complain about federal control of the public school system, and they should, because it's, you know, it's a great way to raise up little generations of Marxists. Gutting, if not eliminating, the Department of Education would be something that we should all get behind, and he hasn't really yet changed his tune on that. And so I would think that conservatives in Congress really ought to get behind that, not just for the education aspect, which I think is obviously enough, but also the way that the Department of Education wields this Title IX money, this massive amount of federal money that is taken by force through our tax dollars, that is then doled back out to the states in order to fulfill whatever functions the Department of Education says. So this is the way that, you know, the Common Core, which the left continued to cry that this is not federally mandated. Well, no, but then we just don't give you money for things if you don't do things the way that we want you to. And that, of course, became an issue in North Carolina over the famous transgender restroom bill, and became a way for the White House, for President Obama, to threaten the state by withholding billions of dollars through Title IX money. But it seemed to me that gutting the Department of Education and sending it back to the states that is to say the administration of education programs. It certainly would create diversity, but in approaches to education, and sadly I live in Illinois, so a whole lot probably wouldn't change there, but there would be options. There would be real federalism there, even in the approach toward something that should be controlled locally. But it also, in addition, would take away this kind of money source that the federal government can hold over the heads of state and threaten to withdraw.
Aaron Wolf is managing editor of Chronicles, a magazine of American culture, author of a recent column titled Roll Up Your Sleeves, Deplorables. You can read it at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Aaron, thank you very much for your time.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Brian Ketchelmeyer will join us on the other side of the break to begin a series on Psalms 1, 2, and 3. I'm Todd Wilkin. Stay tuned. At Concordia University Irvine, you can pursue advanced theological study for academic, professional, or personal development. Concordia's Master of Arts in Theology program is grounded in the truth of Scripture and insights from the Lutheran Confessions. Courses are taught online and at intensive on-campus sessions in the summer. Apologetics, Christian education leadership, and Reformation studies are just a few of the emphases offered. For more information, visit cui.edu/theology.
College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois offers ACT, SAT, and PSAT test prep, scholarship application classes, college and career counseling, and more. Hi, this is Lori Konski, president of College Preparation Station. We have helped our students obtain more than $7 million in tuition scholarships in 12 years. Find out more at cpsprep.com. Let us help you create a vision and find your future. The College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois, cpsprep.com.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Does the gospel free you to do what you want? I've written an article in the latest Issues, Etc. journal titled Better Than Good, Failed Attempts to Improve on the Gospel. You can read it by subscribing to the online Issues, Etc. journal. Just click the red subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. You can also read Pastor Brian Ketchelmeyer's spiritual journey from Roman Catholicism and American Evangelicalism to Confessional Lutheranism, the free online Issues Etc. journal.
Recently graduated from high school or college and looking for a chance to serve a community in need while sharing the good news of Jesus Christ? Lutheran Young Adult Corps may be for you. Lutheran Young Adult Corps provides opportunities for long-term, full-time service for 10 weeks through the summer or 10 months over the school year in places like St. Louis, Philadelphia, and Boston. Find out more about Lutheran Young Adult Corps by finding us online at lcms.org/YACORPS or on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Lutheran YA Corps.